God aften og velkommen til Radio Shalom. Vi sender på 87,6 på FM-båndet og på 90,6 på hybrid. Radio Shalom sender hver aften mandag til torsdag fra kl. 18.30 til 20. Hver tredje onsdag sender vi på Yiddish. Lørdag aften kl. 22 til 24 sender vi musik. Søndag formiddag kl. 10 til 12 sender vi ugens magasin. Og søndag kl. 16 til 20 sender vi på hebraisk. Og man kan få meget mere at vide om Radio Shalom ved at gå ind på hjemmesiden. Den hedder www.radioshalom.dk. Og herfra kan man også lytte til udsendelserne, enten via en kategori eller en dato. Og her på Radio Shalom vil vi altid gerne høre fra lytterne. Enten så kan man sende os en mail. Her er adressen info@radioshalom.dk. Eller også kan man ringe til studiet. Telefonnummeret her er 35 85 86 11.
God aften og velkommen til Radio Shalom. I studiet i dag sidder Alexander Mikdagslav, det er mig, og jeg har Joanna Sawyer sammen med mig. Og aftens udsendelse, den består af to forskellige programmer. Det første, det er Lea Fomanskis optagelse af forfatteren Sally Altshuler, som fortæller om sine rødder, om sin familie i Østeuropa. Og derefter kommer Joanna Sawyer og fortæller om arkitekturens værksteder, som hedder Elemental, og det er en udstilling, som er på Louisiana i dag.
I dag skal vi høre Sally Altshuler, der er børnebogsforfatter, fortælle dels om sit forfatterskab, og dels om sin familie og hvor han stammer fra. Han er en spændende mand, som er uddannet som skolelærer og har skrevet børnebøger i lang tid og samarbejdet med forskellige folk i udlandet, blandt andet i Vietnam og i Nepal. Det lyder til at blive meget spændende, og det tror jeg altså også, det bliver.
Sally. Velkommen. Vi har ventet længe, og jeg har haft dig i tankerne længe, og tænkt, okay, nu venter vi til tiden kommer. Og det er kommet. Og velkommen til Ida.
Ja, det er mig.
Ja, det er dig. Og det er dejligt, at din søn kan få dig til at komme her.
Ja, ja, ja.
Og velkommen til nogen. Og til jer alle andre. Jeg vil sige, inden vi starter med vores foredrag eller oplæg, så vil jeg bare invitere jer. Jeg ved, at der er flere, der ved det, at Paul Bachmann er død. Og, ja, og begravelse er i morgen kl. 13:30. Okay? Værsgo.
Tak. Jeg er glad for at være her. Og jeg er glad for, at jeg kunne slippe min mor herhen. Kan I høre, hvad jeg siger?
Ja.
Jeg skal fortælle jer noget om en bog, jeg har skrevet. Det er sådan, at jeg hedder Sally Altshuler, og jeg har levet af at være forfatter de sidste 20 år. Jeg er uddannet som skolelærer, og har også arbejdet som skolelærer i mange år inden da. Jeg har mest skrevet bøger for børn, og efterhånden er det vel blevet til omkring 40 stykker. Se, på et tidspunkt, der havde jeg jo gået og hørt en hel del af alle de historier, som vi fortalte i familien omkring, hvordan slægten havde boet der i Ukraine, og hvordan de var kommet til Danmark og så videre. Og der var alle mulige mere eller mindre troværdige historier. Og jeg havde i mange år gået og drømt om at lave en eller anden form for en slægtshistorie. Og udgangspunktet ville jo så være min farmor, som hed Dunja, og hun blev jo så gift Altshuler, fordi hun blev gift med min farfar. Men hendes fødenavn var Khishur. Og hun sagde jo altid, at hun var vokset op i Ukraine.
Så må jeg få en til at gå ind og hente.
Og boede i en lille by, der hed Antonovka, og senere voksede op hos en moster, eller hvad det nu var, i Dnepropetrovsk, en stor industriby ved Dnepropetrovsk i Ukraine. Det var sådan set, hvad jeg vidste. Så vidste jeg, at farmor og farfar, de kom til København i 1912. Og i 1919, der havde de fået 5 børn. Den sidste, det er min far, Hirsch Avram. Og den ældste, som blev født kun en måned efter, at farmor kom til København, det er Sara. Og det er Ritas mor. Rita sidder der. Og det er Sara, altså min faster. Og der er ikke nogen, der blev født. Der kom min farmor og farfar til Danmark. Ja, okay. Ja. Se, så går der jo selvfølgelig nogle år, og familien vokser, trives, og jeg ved ikke præcis, hvornår det her billede er taget, men det er jo så alle farmor og farfars børn, næsten, jeg tror der mangler en, og deres koner og så videre. Og det her, det er simpelthen min mor, som sidder der. Ja, ja. Ja, ja, men der brugte du jo også læbestift og alt sådan noget. Det gik jo sådan set meget godt. På det her tidspunkt var jeg ikke født endnu. Det blev jeg i 1953. Så på et eller andet tidspunkt, så begyndte jeg så at interessere mig for, jamen, hvad ved vi egentlig om den her familien Altschuler? Min mors familie, de var jo fra Sverige, vokset op i Lund, og man kan sige, at i min mors familie var de ikke så snaksalige, som de var i min fars familie. Og derfor ved jeg mest om min fars familie. Og en af de mest snaksalige, det var faktisk faster Sara. Og udover at hun godt kunne lide at fortælle om alt muligt, så lavede hun jordens bedste kagekuchen. Og brugte jeg meget hende som kilde. Og hun er, som jeg sagde, hun er født i 1912 i november. Hvad er det, jeg skrev i dag? Ja, i går, ikke? Er det ikke? Den 10-11-12, ja, var hun født, ja. Ja. Der ville hun så være blevet 106. Ja. Så jeg satte mig sammen med faster Sara en gang imellem i Valby. Og så snakkede vi, og jeg optog det hele på bånd, og så drak vi næstkaffe og spiste kagekuchen, og det var vældig, vældig hyggeligt. Så jeg har mange timers båndoptagelse, hvor hun fortæller alle mulige historier. Og sådan med årene, så begyndte der ligesom at tegne sig et billede. Og det er jo det her område, vi taler om. Og farmor talte jo meget om, at hun var født i Dnepropetrovsk, hun ligger der, stor industriby. Eller der var hun ikke født, der voksede hun op, men hun var født i Antonovka. Problemet var, at jeg vidste ikke, hvor Antonovka lå henne. Ikke andet, jeg havde sådan nogle ting, jeg kunne gå efter, og det var blandt andet, at hun fortalte, at hun, hun sejlede hjem og besøgte familien i Antonovka en gang imellem. Og så sejlede hun på Dnieperfloden, fordi Antonovka lå ganske tæt på Dnieperfloden. Og der sejlede hun med sådan nogle parachot floddampere, som var et helt almindeligt transportmiddel på de store russiske floder. Så jeg vidste, at Antonovka måtte ligge et eller andet sted i nærheden af Dnieperfloden. Og hun sagde jo også, at hun var fra Ukraine, så det måtte ligge i Ukraine. Se, nu vidste jeg også, at der måtte være noget skov i nærheden, fordi at min tipoldefar og min oldefar, de arbejdede med skov. De havde et par køer, som de malkede, og så lavede de smør, men de arbejdede også i skoven. Så jeg skulle altså finde et eller andet sted i nær ved Dnieperfloden, hvor der var noget skov, og det skulle være i Ukraine. Så nu er det bare sådan, at i Ukraine, der er der altså ikke ret meget skov. Jeg fik kontakt med en sådan en skovspecialist fra Ukraine via nettet, som var meget behjælpsom og prøvede på at guide mig, men der var ikke rigtig noget skov af betydning. Nå, men så skete der det, at jeg fik et rejselegat, sådan så jeg kunne rejse til Ukraine og selv kigge på forholdene. Lagde jeg en rute sådan, fra Kiev rejste sammen med min søn. Vi skal lige tilbage og se det her. Det der er mindesmærket lige uden for Kiev ved Babi Yar. Der har man rejst det her mindesmærke. Jeg synes lige, jeg ville vise det, når jeg nu havde været der. Og Babi Yar er jo altså et af de steder, hvor at der blev myrdet 10.000vis af jøder ved den nazistiske okkupation. Se, sådan så en typisk stadel ud omkring århundredeskiftet, altså ved omkring år 1900. Den her er fra Polen sandsynligvis. Og man kan jo godt se, at det er jo ikke luksus, der ligesom præger billedet. Det var fattige folk. Der er jo selvfølgelig, vi kender jo alle sammen en masse af de der historier fra de jødiske stædler og musikken ikke mindst. Jeg havde jo stadig det problem, at jeg ikke vidste, hvor Antonovka lå henne. Men jeg begyndte at skrive, og jeg gjorde så det, at jeg fulgte Dnieperfloden på et kort med en blyant, og så fulgte jeg den nordpå, for jeg tænkte, det er der, hun var rejst med den her parachot. Og på et tidspunkt, så satte jeg simpelthen, hvor der var noget skov, så siger jeg, nu leger jeg, at det er her. Nu siger jeg, så kan jeg begynde at skrive herfra. Og det var i nærheden af en by, som hed Mosil. Den var bare ikke i Ukraine, men det gjorde jeg ikke så meget, tænkte jeg. Jeg kunne altid lave det om, hvis jeg fandt ud af noget andet. Ja. Den var nemlig nord for grænsen, og inde i Hviderusland. Og der var masser af skov, for der lå nemlig Pripyat-sumpene og sådan noget. Så tænkte jeg, nu leger jeg det her, og så går jeg videre, og så rejste jeg. Men umiddelbart inden jeg rejste, havde min fætter, jeg tror det var Arno, han havde fundet nogle papirer, hvor han havde gjort nogle notater, omkring det, som faster Sara havde sagt. På det her tidspunkt var faster Sara død. Men han havde noteret, at Antonovka lå i nærheden af en by, der hed Kalinkovici. Se, og Kalinkovici, det var en noget større by. Den var nem at finde på et kort. Nu skal jeg lige vise jer den her. Den er her. Den ligger der. Og hernede ligger floden, som så er en biflod til Dnieper, som hedder Pripyat. Stor flod, meget stor, som man meget nemt kan sejle på. Og så kiggede jeg grundigt, og så jeg, at 5-6 kilometer uden for Kalinkovici, der lå en lille flække, der hed Antonovka. Og jeg tænkte, det er sgu nok her. Det hele passede. Og bortset fra, at det altså lå i Hviderusland. Men grænserne er jo blevet, har jo flyttet sig. Dengang var det hele jo det russiske imperium. Om det lå sådan lidt nord for det, der var grænsen til Hviderusland eller syd for, det var så vidt ligegyldigt. Det kunne sagtens have flyttet sig. Så det passede fint. Se, og det, der var det rigtig mærkelige, det var, at det lå mindre end 10 kilometer fra det sted, hvor jeg mere eller mindre tilfældigt havde placeret min byant og sagt, nu leger jeg, at det ligger her. Det gjorde det. Så kan man jo spekulere lidt over, hvad det kan betyde. Men det er ikke desto mindre et faktum. Se, ham her kender de fleste af jer, sikkert. Det er Tevje. Og I husker måske, at Tevje boede i en by, der hed Anatevke. Og Anatevke, det er bare en anden måde at sige Antonovka på. Og Tevje var mælkemand, fuldstændig ligesom min tiboldefar, som hed Dallet. Det var jo selvfølgelig Shalom Aleichem, som skrev mælkemanden Tevje. Og han var født og levede i en by, som vi kørte igennem, som ligger lige ud til Dnieperfloden, som hedder nej, nu har jeg lige glemt, hvad den hedder, men det er også lige meget. Men vi kørte igennem der, en meget hyggelig og fin by i øvrigt, hvor Shalom Aleichem havde boet. Så det var sådan, alle tingene passede på en eller anden mærkelig måde. Det var vældig fint alt sammen. Se, jeg lavede jo en masse research. Jeg prøvede jo at efterforske, sådan, altså hvad jeg kunne finde ud af fakta. Og der findes nogle steder på nettet, hvor man faktisk kan finde ud af fantastisk mange ting. Det lykkedes mig faktisk at finde så noget fra min farfars familie. Han var født i en by, der hedder Zgirsk, uden for Łódź i Polen. Det lykkedes mig faktisk at finde hans fødselsdokumenter, hans attester. Og der står jo så her på russisk, ikke på polsk. Det er fordi myndighederne, de var jo russiske. Så alle ting blev skrevet på russisk. Og igen så hjalp min fætter Arno mig med at få det oversat. Og der står jo så her, dette her er skrevet ned i byen Zgirsk den 27.10.1892. Så står der i parentes 8.11.1892 kl. 11. Og den første dato er den julianske, for det var jo den, man brugte i Rusland, og som man stadig bruger altså i den russisk-katolske kirke, ligesom vi bruger den jødiske kalender i den jødiske religion. Og den anden, det er så den gregorianske kalender, altså den 8.11. Nå, så står der Moshe Altshuler, og det er jo så min oldefar, som er 33 år gammel, som har fast arbejde og bor i Zgirsk, kom selv til kontoret og var ledsaget af vidnerne Wolf Lassmann, som er 32, og Abbe Markovic, som er 44. Begge handlende og beboere i vores by. Han præsenterede et drengebarn og fortalte, at Barnet var født i Sigirsk den 7.10.1890. Den 19.10.1890. Det var så det, som vi regnede for min farfars fødselsdag. Læg mærke til, at der er 2 års forskel fra, at barnet er blevet født, og til de ligesom får tid til at komme ind på kontoret i Sigirsk og ligesom at gøre noget ved det. Og moren er hans helt legale kone, Zise Feige, som kommer fra familien Buchhalter, og som i dag er 33 år. Drengebarnet fik navnet Favel. Dette dokument er blevet læst af alle tilstedeværende, og er blevet underskrevet af os, undtagen drengens far, som ikke kan læse. Og det er lidt interessant, fordi så tilføjer jo min fætter Arno, ja, han kunne nok ikke læse russisk, men han kunne læse jiddisch og hebraisk. Og det er jo sjovt at finde sådan nogle dokumenter. Jeg har faktisk fundet et tilsvarende fra min farfars lillebror, som ved den samme lejlighed blev fremstillet for registrering. Så de havde simpelthen ventet, til de havde et par stykker med at bevæge sig ind på kontoret for at få dem registreret. Og så langt om længe, så fik vi ændret vores rute og sådan noget fra, i stedet for at køre sydpå, så kørte vi så til Kalinkovici og prøvede så at køre ud til Antonovka. Vi var inde i rådhuset der. Nu skulle man jo tro, at Europas sidste diktatur, som man kalder Hviderusland, at de var sådan meget afvisende og sådan noget. Men på rådhuset i Kalinkovici, hvor herr Lenin, han stadig står og dekorerer det hele, der var de utrolig imødekommende og venlige. Vi kom en fredag eftermiddag, hvor man skulle tro, at de havde travlt med at gå hjem. Kom ind, sæt jer ned, få noget te, og hvad kan vi hjælpe jer med? Og jeg havde jo en tolk med fra Ukraine, og en jødisk kvinde, som var engelsklærer i Ukraine, og det var jo helt nødvendigt. Men altså, vi fortalte så, at vi ledte efter den her Rishva og Antonovka, skulle hun være født, og jamen, siger hun, det ved vi jo godt, fordi altså ude i Antonovka, der er jo stadig en vej, som hedder Jødevejen. Der er ikke nogen jøder, men der er en vej, der hedder Jødevejen. Og så ringede hun til alle mulige mennesker for at høre, om de vidste noget, og hun ringede til formanden for det lille jødiske samfund, som stadig var i Kalinkovici. Og
efter en halv time eller en time.
Så tog vi ud og besøgte ham. Det er så ikke ham her. Nu skal jeg lige se, om jeg kan finde den i billedet her. Det er også lige meget. I hvert fald formanden der, som hed Timofey et eller andet, han serverede jordbær for os, og så da jeg sagde Rishva, så sagde han, Rishva? Sagde du Rishva? Ja, ja, min farmor, hun var født Rishva. Jamen, så skal du da møde Yitzhak Rishva. Han er født ude på Jødevejen i Antonovka. Og han boede derinde i Kalinkovici nu. Så kørte vi ud, han ringede så til ham, og jamen, kom, og så kørte vi ud til Yitzhak Rishva. Han er jo så en generation efter, fordi altså, vi er i 2007 nu, og han var i begyndelsen af 70'erne eller sådan noget. Og det vil jo så sige, at han er den næste generation, for han kendte jo selvfølgelig ikke min farmor. Men han kunne jo så fortælle os, at så mange, der hed Rishva, boede der altså ikke på Jødevejen, så vi var helt sikkert i familie. Det var jo fantastisk. Der fik vi jo altså gåsehud, både min søn Simon og jeg. Jeg vil lige omkring... nej, jeg vil lige gå lidt videre her. Se, og vi skulle jo selvfølgelig til Antonovka. Der står Antonovka på russisk. Og det er jo så min søn Simon, som i mellemtiden er blevet 10 år ældre. Det er jeg også, men det kan man ikke se. Og det var jo fantastisk. Fordi vi spurgte jo lidt folk her, hvad med den der jødevej? Ja, men det er den der. Altså, det er jødevejen i Antonovka, og det hedder den stadig. Og der var storke alle vejene, og det hele passede med, pludselig kunne jeg huske et eller andet med, at farmor havde sagt en gang, at der var en vandmølle for enden. Og der lå sådan et vandløb for enden af vejen der. Jeg kan ikke se, om der havde været en vandmølle, men den vandmølle kom til at spille en rolle i romanen. Altså det var jo fuldstændig fantastisk. Og som jeg sagde, så alle folk vi mødte var yderst snaksagelige og prøvede det bedste de kunne for at hjælpe os. Og viste os fra den, nej, men så skal I gå hen og snakke med hende, fordi hun dengang og så videre. Og det var meget rar oplevelse at møde disse mennesker. Se, nu går vi lige tilbage til det her, fordi I kan sikkert huske, at jeg nævnte det der med det mærkelige med, at det viste sig, at Antonovka lå det sted, hvor jeg bare helt tilfældigt havde placeret det. Hvor jeg ligesom havde lejet, det var. Se, sådan nogle ting skete der flere gange, da jeg så for alvor gik i gang med at skrive den her roman. Jeg skal ikke sige så meget om selve indholdet og sådan noget, for det er sådan rimelig kompliceret. Men på et tidspunkt, så opfinder jeg en person. Hun er rabbinerdatter, men stikker af, fordi at hun ikke vil giftes med den mand, som familien havde tiltænkt sig. Og hun kommer på en eller anden måde i kontakt med sådan nogle af de der første revolutionære kræfter i Rusland. Og anarkisterne, som jo planlagde at udføre det attentat på Tsaren i 1891. Se, for at få det hele til at hænge sammen, så udstyrede jeg hende med en veninde. Og det var noget, jeg fandt på. Jeg skrev, at hun, da hun kom til Petersborg, kom hun ind i de her kredse med anarkister, der mødte hun så den her jævnaldrende kvinde, som var vokset op i byen Masur, som nærmest var tvillingby til Kalinkovici, og at også hun var flygtet fra et arrangeret ægteskab. Det passede fint i min historie. Det, der er interessant og decideret mærkeligt, det er, at efterhånden som jeg researchede, undersøgte mere og mere omkring det her attentat på Tsaren. Der var 5 mennesker bagefter, som blev anklaget. Og de blev alle sammen henrettet, undtagen den ene, fordi hun var kvinde og fordi hun var gravid. Det er hende. Hun var født i Mosir, var stukket af hjemmefra, fordi hun ikke ville giftes med den mand, som var udset til at være kom ind i de der revolutionære kræfter og deltog i planlægningen og udførelsen af attentatet på Tsaren. Hun hed nu har jeg lige glemt, hvad hun hedder. Ja. Hvad pokker hed hun? Det står i mit bog. Nå, men det mærkelige er jo, altså, og det er virkelig, virkelig mærkeligt, at altså, det var jo bare noget, jeg havde fundet på. Og så passede det. Altså, det passede også med, hvor hun var født, og med, altså, det eneste, jeg så ikke fandt på, det var det der med, at hun ikke blev henrettet, fordi hun var gravid. Historien er så, at hun var jo så fængslet, og så skulle hun så nedkomme i fængslet. Det var en meget kompliceret fødsel, hun døde simpelthen under den her fødsel. Og barnet overlevede, men man ved ikke rigtigt, hvad der skete med det her barn. Det, der er det mærkelige, og det ved man historisk, at zarens livlæge var til stede ved den fødsel. Hvad lavede han dog der? Ja, det var sådan ret mistænkeligt. Hun hed Gesia. Gesia et eller andet. Ja.
Så
kommer hun lidt. Men det er jo helt forunderligt, det der med, at det, man sidder og skriver og digter og sådan noget, det går hen og bliver til virkelighed. Og det vil så sige, at man skal passe rigtig, rigtig meget på, hvad man sidder og digter, fordi pludselig er det bare rigtigt. Så, men skal I se her. Her, jeg vil lige... hende her. Er der nogen her, som forstår russisk? Vi prøver lige at se, om vi kan få hende til at sige noget. Fordi vi interviewede hende. Skal vi lige se, om I kan høre det?
Она уже 90
годов. Так она уходит.
Ikke
så højt. Kan du høre det? Kan det blive højere? Jeg synes, jeg så en fjernbetjening.
Живая. Уже я на 90 годов она живая. Где поэтому? Ну, сын живет у Паша.
Ну, да.
Ну, Паша.
Ну, его мать.
Мать его мать.
Мама, ты знаешь, про что расскажи? Okay. Ты же мне рассказала, что вот в этом...
Болики.
Вот она может знать. Она уже 90 годов живет. Так я не... Она у Гали живет.
Мама, кто?
Антонина.
Антоня Садовская, ну, Данилкова, ну, она живая, уже я на 90-е годы, она живая.
Måske er det heller ikke rigtig russisk, det er måske hviderussisk. Men det der... Det er hendes søn. Se, det der er sjovt, det er, at hun fortæller om en herremand, som var simpelthen ham, der ejede hele området der dengang, altså før revolutionen selvfølgelig, omkring Erntenovka. Han hed Sadovski. Og hun fortæller om et eller andet, han var til grin, fordi han fik bygget en sådan et badehus, hvor han så faldt, og åbenbart var så tyk, så han kunne ikke komme op og stå selv. Og sådan noget. Og det sjove er, at den Sadovski har min farmor fortalt om. Hun fortalte nemlig om, hvordan at når han kom på besøg, så stod hele byen. Er det ikke rigtigt, Rita?
Altså,
så skulle de stille sig op på rette række, alle indbyggerne med lys, og så fik han brød og salt. Det var den måde, man... Og så faster Sara siger så, at farmor plejede sig at sige, at alle de kønne piger, dem stillede de bagest, fordi at dem skulle han helst ikke få øje på. til sidst, så vil jeg lige spille det her. Det er fra, bagefter så rejste vi ned til Odessa, besøgte blandt andet et jødisk plejehjem, som var næsten lige så fint som det bordcenteret. Det må jeg sige, det var virkelig, virkelig pænt. Snakkede med nogen, og det var de mest fantastiske historier, de kunne fortælle, altså fra krigen og sådan noget. Det kan jeg slet ikke komme ind på her. Det var helt vanvittige historier. Men så optog vi også den her dame, som på det tidspunkt var et par 90, og hun ville gerne synge, fordi de andre sagde, at hun sang så smukt. Mm-hmm. Så, og det synes jeg lige, I skal have lov at høre.
Ой, вигликах он райки с дырмой чвасов, а за шейным отзвоны не шейнт он год, а за налдычки и дыши мамы, мамы.
Ja, og altså, det synes jeg, det er sådan en udmærket punktum at sætte for det her foredrag. Hvis der er nogen, der vil spørge om noget, så er I selvfølgelig velkomne.
Ja, jeg vil gerne vide titlen på den bog.
Jamen, nu skal I se, jeg har den jo faktisk her.
Det må være nok heldigt.
Den hedder En engel bag øret, og der er ikke mange eksemplarer tilbage, men hvis man går ind i en boghandel, vil jeg gætte på, at de kan skaffe et. Jeg kan dog nok selv skaffe dem mere. Så, men den blev også lavet, jeg lavede den også i en version for børn, som hedder Min tibollefar var russer og havde slangekrøller. Og den kan skaffes i hvert fald.
Hvor mange år siden var det? Er det, at du var der?
Jeg var der i 2007. Ja, så det er 10-11 år siden. Ja. Så, ja.
Men hvor mange steder talte man stadig jiddisch?
På hjemmet i Odessa, der talte de jiddisch. Men der var ingen jøder tilbage i Antonovka. Så var der jo så nogen i menigheden i Odessa der. Og det var sådan en rabatmenighed. Og der var der nogen, der talte jiddisch. Men ellers var der ikke så mange, der talte jiddisch. Det var der ikke.
Havde de et godt jødisk liv dernede?
Altså, i Kalinkovici var der et par hundrede medlemmer af menigheden. Og det var fattigt område, ikke? Men altså, vi snakkede med ham, formanden, og med Isaac Christopher der, og de var vældig tilfredse. Altså, ham der diktatoren i Hvide Rusland, som jeg af en eller anden grund aldrig kan huske, hvad hedder, han styrer det jo med hård hånd. Og det er de godt klar over. De siger, at den politiske frihed, vi ikke har, den er så erstattet af en eller anden form for religionsfrihed. Altså, vi kan få lov at dyrke vores religion. Vi skal bare lade være med at kritisere styret.
Ja, ja.
Okay. Så de var tilfredse, og i Odessa, der bor jo bare 100.000 jøder. Der foregik altså meget. Det gjorde der. Der var et levende kulturliv. Vi var til, der var flere synagoger, og vi var til Shabbos gudstjeneste i en af dem, og det var fint. Nej, det er lige ved siden af Krim. Ja, lige ved siden af. Så. Men det var på alle måder en meget udbytterig rejse. Ja.
Den næste udsendelse er på engelsk. Den handler om en aktuel udstilling i Louisiana. Udstillingen er en arkitekturudstilling og handler om arkitekturens rolle i samfundsudvikling. I den første del byder Louisianas direktør og udstillingens kurator velkommen til gæster og til alle medarbejdere, som er arkitekter fra firmaet Elemental.
Som I måske ved, så viser vi arkitekturudstillinger en gang om året, så de fleste har jo været der hver gang, vi har en åbning. Og efter vi i en lang periode har lavet tematiske udstillinger, så er vi nu taget ud på en serie, som er monografiske udstillinger under en fælles titel, som vi kalder Arkitekturens Værksteder. Den første udstilling, håber jeg, I så, det var også i de her lokaler, og det var med den kinesiske arkitekt Wang Xu og hans kone Lu Wenyu med deres berømte tegnestue, Amateur Architecture Studio. Og vi ønsker denne serie at komme tættere på en enkelt tegnestues arbejdsproces. Det er ligesom ideen med hele udstillingen. Så vi har valgt arkitekter, synes vi selv, til den her serie, som udover at de laver god arkitektur, så gør de også en forskel. De arkitekter, som er optaget af verdens udfordringer, såsom bæredygtighed, klimaforandringer, politiske og sociale udfordringer, og deres egen kulturarv. Og det er også noget af det, der gennemsyrer det, eller man selv laver. So, I will continue in English so everybody understands it. We have showed elemental architecture before here at Luciana as a part of the exhibition with the title Living in 2011, maybe somebody can remember it. And we showed one of your social houses projects. So the audience in Luciana already know a little bit about your works, but it's good to continue. Here behind us, you can see a long row. It's a row of panels called Making of a Kind of Timeline. And it's a complete updated documentation of the genesis of the exhibition. And it extends over a year and a half. I can't remember the first date here. And maybe it will continue in the other expos after the exhibition open here. I met with the Elemental group. As you can see when you are going through it, there are several photos. And I met them in Venice, in Santiago, and here in Luciana, in different workshops to make the whole exhibition. And it had been a great and fruitful dialogue. Your first idea, when we talked about content, was to move the whole studio to Luciana for a while, open for the public, so you could work here. But the content changed, but you are all here now, so it's something related to what we started with. Not only the partners are here, but the whole group from the office and the families, some 45 people. Often you focus on how far we are in Scandinavia from South America, the North-South dialogue, you call it, Surtico versus Nordico. So the exhibition have the title, maybe you have seen it, the title is So Far, which also focus on where we are now with the exhibition, and you can, the result is here. So the distance to South America and where we are now. The whole exhibition is divided in four parts. The first section, what you see in the first big space, it's about what is elemental. And it's an installation inspired by local vernacular tradition, a structure, a kind of counterweight structure. And it fit in between the four columns, and it's made for the space. And the construction is one of the studio's most important tools. It's the sketchbook, and you can see a large selection of the sketchbooks, and you can see what's inside the sketchbooks. And I have learned how important the book is as a working tool in the process. So the first thing I got when we had the meeting in Santiago was a sketchbook of my own. So, but it's not in the exhibition. I have it private in my office. So it had followed me through the whole process. So for me, it's like a timeline here, the whole sketchbook. After the space here followed the balcony, and it's a story about Elemental's very famous work, social housing, the so-called half houses. And also here on the balcony, you can see the studio's latest work, the work as designer also, the smallest thing they make, it's a series of new lamps. So you can see they also work in the small scale. And here, where you are standing now, so it's the title of this space is the title of the exhibition So Far, and this is the third section in the exhibition. And as you can see, it's the biggest installation in the exhibition. And it's about balance and floating volumes, active, and also things related to the way Elemental work with architecture. And you can see some of their projects related to this scene at the backside of this big installation. It has been a great job to make the whole cube here, and we also used an engineer in Germany, and we have a lot of people in Denmark working on this. You can see the whole cube is floating, so if you dare to go in, there is a film, so you can lie on the floor and you can see a new things made for the exhibition. You see some of the architecture from a drone, so it's a new way of seeing architecture. So I hope you take time to lay down, or you can also sit down, but it's better to lay down. So. Finally, you can see under the balcony here, the last story is what it's called. It has something to do with open source design. It's about a chair called the City Chair, and it's different chair elements in different constellations. And maybe people from the Elemental Group will explain it a little bit later for what's going on in this area. I have some things about the way we are doing the exhibition. You know, the exhibition is supported by Realdania, and they have supported the architectural exhibition here for many years, and the main sponsor for architectural program here. And for the exhibition, I don't have a catalog here, but maybe you have it or you have seen it. We have published a monograph, a catalog edited by Lærke Uldal and of course Mette Marie Kallehauge. And Mette Marie Kallehauge, she is also curator of the exhibition. So thank you. Where you are. Yeah. And you can read about the exhibition in the Louisiana magazine. I know you see Elemental as a kind of family, a working family. And I always feel we are a Louisiana family when you make exhibition. So two families working together is great. And from the Louisiana family, I would like to mention Ulrik Stoll Dinesen, a kind of, it's called exhibition producer. And also we have our own architect, Brian Lottenburg. We have our graphic designer, Maria Lübecker, somewhere maybe. And we have a coordinator at the whole scenes, Marianne Arnsberg, standing there. So thank you for all your work in the Louisiana family. Now I will pass on the words to the Elemental Group.
I den anden del fortæller arkitekterne om deres sociale ansvar og de boligprojekter til fattige, som de har bygget.
And maybe one explanation, that if people come here, they're supposed and they're allowed and they're encouraged to go inside and lay on the ground under the cube. The reason for that is not just to find a new way to look at things, but we were saying that we're always trying to look for what's the common language, or try to bring architecture to its more fundamental aspects. Being one of them, for example, the forces at play, gravity, it's a fact. We are all affected by gravity. So we in our projects, tend to use gravity as kind of fundamental truth that we all share. It's a kind of universal thing. And gravity, by expressing it in massive values, or in this case, by having all the weight of the cube here expressed in the counterbalance over there. But as gravity, for example, it's one of those architectural facts. There are some situations, like a shortcut, for example, is one of those forces that you better agree with. Or lying on the ground. I mean, the moment you lie on the ground and put your back on the ground, I mean, looking even at a tree in a park, you could be sitting on the floor. The moment you lie on the ground, a complete different experience appears. I mean, it's the way eventually gravity affects your back or something. So we're trying to engage in between the sketch and the final building in forces that, even if you don't realize consciously, create that bridge. And so that, because in the end, architecture is nothing that giving form to the places where people live. The moment you double click on each of these words, then the real problem starts. What is light? It's just functions, or it's just aesthetics, or it's all of them. So how many forces can we find that in that simple, in principle, apparently simple act of giving form to the places where people live, the final result will actually improve people's life? Because if we make a mistake as architects, it will last there for a long time. So you better make sure that if you are going to be able to produce some good, that it lasts as much as possible. That's why the attention on the construction, so that it lasts, on the structure, so that it holds, and on the forces, so that it engages and actually agrees with life. So if you could please encourage people, in case they don't know, to not just sit and lie on the ground to experience this kind of atavic fundamental fact, would be great. And maybe the other one, as Kjell mentioned, we at Elemental are in total 15 or 17. Architects, actually, we are 13. And the whole office came here. Actually, now the office in Santiago is closed. Nobody is there. And we all came here, and some of us also with family and everything. But I would like to thank personally, and especially Federica and Clem, the two architects at Elemental. So actually 20% of the office was dedicated to the exhibition, and I think it's a very important, we're very happy. And also thankful for the Luciana and the sponsor. To make a sketch become this, it takes a huge amount of knowledge and dedication, and we've been very impressed by your capacity, your skills and knowledge, and we've learned a lot through the process, so thank you so much. So from now on, questions, we are more than happy to answer.
Or maybe you can explain some of the installations to start with.
I can do that, but if somebody has a question before, if you are too shy, I can start. Well, so maybe just two other things. The first room there has the original sketchbooks. The being invited by an art museum to make an exhibition, again, it's a challenge for architects. The biggest difference is that in art, what is displayed and shown is the actual work of the artist. We can't bring our buildings here. So in architecture, you, in the best of the cases, can show representations of the work. It's not the direct experience of architecture itself. That's why we wanted at least in the way we present those representations, that we experience the same forces that affect the buildings out there, like gravity, for example. So being the problem of weight and balancing in the first element where sketches are displayed, or in here, or even in the smallest panels, like laying slightly out of the vertical axis, again, it's gravity holding them together. So it's mediated, but at least some of the forces are the same one, but we don't have the actual architectural final product in here. So the only way we found was that maybe the notion of an original in art, the originals are crucial. In our case, particularly in housing, something that is unique has a value that is close to zero, as opposed to art, where something that is only one in the world has the highest possible value. If you're building for billions, if something was done only once, its value is close to zero. So the clues and the agreements change dramatically. But the only way we found there was something that was unique, but it was not done on purpose like that, it just happens to be like that, is a sketchbook. How to share that original, the moment where you were thinking out loud about something? It's a way so that two people can have a conversation, and we took the opportunity, and that was never did before, that part of the budget, we took it out to scan all the sketchbooks so that you can, and maybe this would be good to explain. I mean, if people come here and look at the sketchbook, there's a plan. On the iPads, if you choose one of those sketchbooks, you can go through every single page of the sketchbook. So this is an archive that we never had. If it was not for this exhibition, we would have never had an archive of our own work. We normally throw away everything that we produce. The only thing that it remains are the sketchbooks. And so we took the opportunity, and all those sketchbooks are there, and for the first time we do have an archive. So that's one thing. And the other thing that is important, and is in the next room, we never documented the housing projects before. And we took the opportunity and the advantage of the exhibition to make a photographical survey. What happened to all the housing projects that we have done so far, hence the title of the exhibition. We wanted to make a kind of anthology or retrospective of what we have done so far. And given housing is important, we wanted to understand how things evolved. This is very important for our work, because we know that half of the square meters are not going to be built by us. So the designs were done already knowing that we lose control of the projects. And this is not a problem, it's actually a good sign. If we do not lose control, then we have a problem. Maybe we made a mistake. If projects were changed, it meant they were successful. And I guess this is opposite again to the world of art, where any alteration without the authorization of the creator, it's a problem. Well, here is a sign that something was good, that it was altered. And there's a very specific reason for this. Evidence shows that a middle-class family throughout the world can live reasonably well in around 80 square meters. Mm-hmm. If you're a rich country, and Scandinavian countries are a model for housing in the world, you deliver apartments owned by the state of around 80, 100 square meters. If you're a middle class and have family savings, then you can live okay in around that built area as well. We ourselves live okay in around that size of housing. But what if there's no money? In the world, public policies of people that do not have access to housing can get, in the best of the cases, around 40 square meters, from 25 to 40 square meters in the form of housing policies. That's a fact. That's the way the world is programmed. If you go to a favela, an informal settlement or a slum, the size of the individual households, even though very bad quality, there are also around 80 square meters per family. So it's a number that matches in public policies, in informal spontaneous living, or in middle class housing. The problem is that when there's no money, governments and markets can deliver 40 square meters. But those 40 square meters are designed as a small, very far away house in peripheries where land costs nothing. So you take the middle class typical shape, and because there's no money, markets reduce it and make a small version of the same house, of course of very poor quality, and families will make them grow anyhow to that size of 80 at a very big cost. Safety is not an issue because they will have to demolish walls, take out roofs. A lot of trouble begin in housing projects when that expansion from social housing to middle class happens despite design and not thanks to design. So we did not give away half houses. What we did was reframe the fact that we cannot deliver a full decent house with public money, but only half of the size, and reframe the problem not as a small house, but 40 square meters as half of that good 80 square meter middle class house. When you reframe the problem of half a good house instead of a small one, the key question is, which half do we do? And a definition of public policy is to do the half that a family cannot do well individually. And we identify a set of design conditions that belong to the half that cannot be done individually by families. Number one, location. So before even going into the design of the house, something that will never ever be able to be changed by a family is where social housing is. The key question is not how many square meters, how much, it's where housing is. Because people come to cities looking for opportunities of jobs, education, health, transportation, recreation. And if you come to cities and then are living in underserved peripheries, excluded and segregated of opportunities, what was the point to coming to cities? So location is the number one thing. And in order, if you don't have enough resources, when I say enough resources, first project happened with a subsidy of $7,500. And with those $7,500, we had to buy the land, provide the infrastructure, and build the house. Normally, this would split in three. So what you have in the end is $2,500 to build the house. The actual design, whatever you can design with that. It is far more important to spend and organize the spending of that money paying for more expensive land, even if that is at the cost of having even less money for the house, because if location is paid and families are well connected within the city, they, for example, do not lose their jobs, and on their own, by not losing jobs, they will be able to keep on completing the house. So what we did too was to transform the scarcity of resources, because one would say, but it's not human, it's not decent to give half of a house, 40 square meters. Well, let's do the exercise of giving bigger houses, 80 square meters. Chile is a small country, 17 million people, $20,000 per capita per year. 100,000 subsidies have to be given every year so that we keep the informal living in slums contained. Chile may be one of the only countries where the level of informality is rather low, being an underdeveloped country. If you double the size of the house, you double the budget. And that means that instead of giving away 100,000 subsidies, we will be given just 50. Those other 50,000 families per year, if they're on the waiting list of the Ministry of Housing too long, they will skip the list and go informal. So it's not an easy equation, and just to, for example, criticize numbers and quantity. Quantity matters, particularly in environments where the social pressure is so big. So, again, not having enough resources, we faced scarcity through incrementality. If you can't do everything now, do now what's more difficult and what will have more impact on common good. And allow the system to complete itself over time. And that's why we knew in advance that half of the square meters were not going to be built by us, and even if we didn't design it like that, those 40 square meters would have appeared anyhow. And this is what evidence shows throughout the world, and this is the case for 2 billion people in the world. So given the opportunity of the exhibition, we went there and documented how the going from social housing to middle class happened. What were the clues? What can we adjust in the design? And so we're again very thankful for the opportunity of this exhibition to generate documents and knowledge that can be shared. Just one last thing, I mentioned one of the conditions of not having enough resources, focusing on what's more difficult now. The other point is that for the majority of those 2 billion people in developing countries needing housing, housing policies are poverty oriented. Unlike in Scandinavia, where the state owns the housing projects, normally for those 2 billion people, the housing subsidy is the biggest transfer of public money into a family asset that families will receive for only for once in their whole lifetime. So they become owners of the house. And one would like that, that public money, as all of us expect when buying a house, to grow its value over time. Unfortunately, in housing, this is closer to buy a car more than buying a house. The value of that property goes down in time. So this is the only asset that the family will have in their lifetime, and one would like it to have its value going up. So that housing is not an expense, but a social investment. So we identified 5 design conditions that allow a housing project to grow its value over time. The first project we did in Iquique, in the north of Chile, in 2003, had that rule of the game, $7,000 to buy land, infrastructure, and house. Actually, out of those $7,500, $7,200 were state subsidy, $300 are family savings. This is a constant in the policies. Families are required to contribute to the overall voucher with some savings. It might take years to those families to save those $300. When we got the Pritzker Prize in 2016, one of the community leaders normally we found that the leaders are women. They are the ones with which we established the dialogue. She came to the office very proud. She happened to be in Santiago for other reasons, medical reasons. And she came to the office for congratulating us for the award. And she said that, you know what, some of the families have sold their houses. Since you're older, you can sell it. Out of the 100 families, 2 families have sold their house. For how much? Well, she was a little bit embarrassed. For how much? And she said, $80,000. So when you multiply by 10, that investment, that family asset that normally will be inherited to children, allow them not just only to have a shelter against the environment. It's a tool to overcome poverty. From that moment on, you're a citizen. You can choose what to do. And you can choose to sell your house. It's fair. But they, much better than us, know exactly how to take advantage of the resources that you were given, if you have resources. So we thought that through the housing projects, we were able to finally transfer value and assets to families so that they can use housing as a tool. And again, this is what we wanted to document with the exhibition. So just to give you an idea, those housing projects are documented there. Under the cube in the films, there's a registration of the other projects, because 1/3 of the office is housing, 1/3 is buildings, another 1/3 is city design. Reconstruction after earthquake and tsunami in 2010 in Chile, or big productive industries in Chile that had relationships with communities like the mining industry, for example. So all these 3/3, and now we began to do some objects and the design as well. So that is somehow how the exhibition was distributed.
Any question, I hope?
Do you have any cooperation with the future inhabitants of the social housing, or
You create a project and then it's offered.
No, by law, but this is on paper. The policy requires that it works like that. Sorry to go very technical, but I think that nerd part is what we actually like. In the policy, when you get a subsidy, you get a voucher. It's a subsidy to the demand, not to the offer. I, with the money in theory in my hand, go to the market to choose where I want. For $7,000, now it's more, but there's nothing to choose. Your choices are very few. But in principle, in addition to getting the money, you get some technical assistance. So all the professionals that should work for your project are paid by the state. The amount is so little that building companies do not employ any architects, so the poor quality of design is explained by nobody paying for thinking better about what to do with scarce resources. And in between brackets, maybe this is important. Social housing is maybe the toughest of the questions. It's a question with intellectual merit. So we're in there not for a second, for any kind of moral superiority because we think, you know, we should work for the poor. We're there because it's a professional challenge that requires and needs professional quality, not professional charity. And it's important that we can prove states and market that if you think that a question matters, you should pay for quality professional time for the entire change, from the designer to the politician making the laws, to the social worker organizing the demand, to the builder, to the end user. And if you don't understand that, it's like expecting social housing to be good just spontaneously. This is not happening in the world, and it's a major social political problem if we do not create the right living conditions if we're living concentrated in space. So finish the project. So as part of the process, you are hired to accompany the families. We, and knowing that half of the square meters are not going to be built by us, ask people to sit on the table on day one so that we can split tasks. We will take care of this, for example. Structure for the final scenario, not for the initial 40, but for the final 80. If we provide the structure for the final 80, we're taking care of something that is very hard to be done properly by a family on their own. Just to mention one thing. To pay for more structure, something has not to be done. What we're not giving in order to pay for this? No finishing, no pavement, no painting. And we agree with the families to do that. And they help us to establish the priorities. Given there's not enough money, what are we not doing to pay what's more expensive? And this is part of the participatory process. During construction, site visits normally are just for professionals. We believe, given they're going to be building half of the next half of the house, we ask them to come to the site visit so that they can begin to technically understand which part of this building can be touched, which can be demolished, which part of the structure can't be touched. So it creates, and this is another myth that I think needs to be erased, is not families themselves building. They're just hiring people that may have the skills to do that, even though we, by taking care of the difficult technical parts, are just enclosing space. It doesn't require too many skills, but some skills. It's not themselves with their own hands building. They do have resources. I mean, one of the previous readings we had is this book by Peruvian economist Hernando de Soto that writes this book, The Mystery of Capital. And he has made studies and shows evidence that in the informal world, there is money. The problem is that money is not spent in the house, because if you don't have property of the land, you spend your money in things that you can take with yourself if you are evicted. A big TV, sneakers, or a car. The moment you get property of the house, all that money goes immediately into the house. That's why there is resources to actually build that, is not necessarily people with themselves. So we qualify workers so that they start a small business by offering families And actually, we have then, in since the size of the void is crucial, what we're designing, what we're really designing, is the with precision what's not built. So in this 3 meters, not 3.2, not 2.8, in 3, there's no material waste. A steel beam is sold in 6 meters. You cut in half, put it inside, and you're not wasting material. Wood is sold in 3.2, that normally the edges are ruined. You cut 10 centimeters inside and put the beam. Wood is 3.2, I mean, in principle, a bigger room, and air costs nothing. Connecting two pieces of wood is technically very complex. So you either add difficulty at a higher cost, or you lose material. So given that the void is very precise, that process happens in good quality without needing quality. So the whole process is accompanied, since we're splitting tasks. What has happened then afterwards, spontaneously, is that you create the relationship with the communities after 2 years, let's say 9 months of design, 1.5 year of construction or something like that. And spontaneously, this organized community reports to us. If there's an earthquake, for example, when in Chile we do have to happen very frequently and very big ones. The last one in 2010 is 8.8 in Richter scale. In Richter scale, that's what we had in addition a tsunami. They report us the state, the physical state of the houses. So it creates a network. But it's a combination of then not needing constant technical assistance. It can take a life on its own. Then the relationship is keeps on being rather horizontal. They still know things that we would like to know and report, and we give advice in case there's needed.
Thank you.
More questions?
Yes, I have one. You're also working outside Chile with different types of projects and commercial. There's a discussion in Denmark about a lot of Danish firms working outside Denmark. There's a discussion about how far can you go concerning, for example, working in countries with no democracy. I wonder if you could comment on that. Where do we have your lines?
Where we?
Where do we have your limits? Working in, for example, in a country without democracy.
First of all, I would say that the need that is there in the world is rather, it doesn't respect countries' boundaries. Who on earth would have thought that you in Europe have a problem with migration? Is it a problem exclusive not having decent housing for people, a problem of underdeveloped countries? I guess that problems have been to begin to cross borders. Every single significant project in the world does not have an ownership. It doesn't have an ownership of a country, nor an ownership of a field of knowledge. This is not an architectural issue, nor an economical or a political issue. By working in Chile, we have been trained in extracting milk out of the stones. I mean, we have to deliver the most with almost no resources. So we do have a knowledge. And I think it would be irresponsible, having need and demand everywhere in the world, not to be able to go there and apply your professional knowledge to challenges that are distributed throughout in the world. So the first thing would say, where are our limits? Geographically, nowhere. Hopefully, we can. And this is, I think, rather an important thing. Normally, the flow of knowledge, money, some kind of hierarchy, is north-south. Given the challenges that we do have nowadays, and being the urban challenge, one of the biggest ones in the world, you know, migration of people moving towards cities, it at a scale of 1 million people city per week, with which we have to respond with $10,000 per family. Do you know how to do this in Denmark? I don't think so. We do. So, finally, there is some flow of knowledge that can go from countries that were required to create skills and knowledge with very few resources, still delivering quality, in this case, housing. Regarding democracy, I think it's so far away, or at least it's not so far away. It's not directly dependent on our field, on architecture, but I do know that if you give people more tools, and instead of being in a slum, where you are very fragile in terms of how to fight and how you create conditions for a non-democratic environment to exist, if at least you can use architecture to have a family out of the mud, having finally connection to basic services, water, sewage, electricity, and with that, in addition, you can enter a system and have an asset and help your children something that is valuable, then the conditions for dictatorships not to expand anymore are created, and even if it's indirect and modest, at least that's the kind of thing that we are interested in doing.
Can I ever come? I was not just only thinking about housing. I was also thinking about building other types of buildings.
Exactly the same thing. In the end, cities are not an accumulation of houses. They are networks of opportunities. So having a public space, quality infrastructure for public transportation or for living, it's exactly the same thing. One of the biggest challenges in the world is inequalities. There's an agreement that we have inequalities. But we tend to associate inequalities directly to income. And the only thing that we listen is, okay, to correct inequalities, redistribute income. Cities are a huge shortcut towards equality, because by identifying strategically projects of infrastructure, public space, housing, transportation, you improve people's qualities of life without having to wait for income to be redistributed. Public space, for example, being one of the most important ones. If you're living in an underserved periphery, you never take holidays. Never, ever take holidays. The park in front of your house, first of all, it doesn't exist. The ratio in an informal piece of land of public space to private land is 1-10. Manhattan is 1-1. In the peripheries, there's less than 1 square meter of public space per inhabitant. London has 44. Cities are measured for what you can do in them for free. So public space has a huge redistributive capacity in quality of life, because if the best part in town is across the street of the worst slums, then for a tiny moment a day, you can have an experience of some quality of life that otherwise would be only be able to be paid with your own money, that for the majority of the world won't happen. Public transportation, the same thing. You don't have a car, you're stuck in traffic far away in peripheries. What if your public transportation system was the state of the art, so good that the rich can also use that? You take that this for granted in Scandinavia. That's not the case for the majority of the world. So having a transportation system that allows that to do is offering quality of life for 2 hours a day in the same shitty house in the periphery, in a place where you were given houses, but at least being seated, for example, in a bus. So when going to work, I'm thinking, maybe you're thinking of which project specifically, of Qatar, or which one, what else?
For example.
So Qatar, half of the square meters are public space. I mean, if you're creating, there's a collection, there's an art collection, that is what triggers there. Not because we are there. In the brief is that half of the space is creating, transforming an industrial facility into public space. You're not guaranteed by that, but if you're improving the quality of public space, then you're creating a condition where you're equalizing at least access to public goods, and this is our modest way to contribute to such environments.
I'd like to ask about the importance of exhibitions in your work, specifically for your practice, but also for architects in general.
I have to confess that for us it's not a normal part of our practice. As I said before, we're a very small practice, and we have to choose to what dedicate our time. Most of that is to building, housing, or public, or cities, or building, whatever it is. It's design. That's our main thing. And so every now and then, we take an exhibition. Of course, the Venice Biennale was the first time we ever curated something. It's a very important thing. It can help. So the thing is like this. We call ourselves a duke tank. The reason for that is that the world is operating nowadays with some rules. being those economical rules, political rules, and within that set of rules, you can improve conditions without expecting them to change. That's one way to operate. So one of the things we decided in housing, and that's how we started, we can, you know, be in our comfortable office and say, look, $7,000 is not enough. We will never, ever be able to produce something. Or within that set of rules, try to change the situation. And for that, you have to think better. And somebody has to pay for that time, and it's important to communicate that. In any case, we accept the rules. In parallel, if those rules need to be changed, and this, I guess, also partially answers the previous answer, then there are different ways to achieve that. You go to a political symposium and try to explain why doing housing in a different way may, with a slight twist, change the condition for 100,000 families per year in a relatively small country. If that's the case, we do that. Or we do a book. Or an exhibition like the Venice Biennale, or in this case, this one, that in addition to change the public opinion, it's important that the public opinion puts pressure so that if some rules of the game need to be adjusted, they're done in that way. That's the case of this exhibition, that you can't imagine how important what somebody is said in developed countries, how much impact that has in developing countries, on one hand. But this specific one, as I said before, allowed us to do two things that we thought was important for our work. Document what we have done so far, particularly in the housing projects, and have an archive that we didn't have. So, doing exhibitions, in our case, will happen only now and then. After this one, I guess that if ever another one happens, it won't be before 2020. So we need some years to recover. A lot of emotional energy goes out of your system when producing an exhibition. And like a sponge, we need to recover that. In addition to that, we do not have that many new things to say. I mean, in architecture, until you accumulate something new to say, it takes time. From the moment you get a commission to the moment it's delivered, if you're lucky, it's 4 years. So you can't be communicating. If you have too many things to say all the time, it's suspicious. I mean, maybe you have a very big office, not our case. So emotion is a crucial part in exhibition. We were talking that the way you accumulate or you transfer knowledge in exhibitions is through emotion. It's not an intellectual, or it is an intellectual thing. You read the thing, you understand something. But it enters into your system through the skin. It's a specific way. So that's the same amount of energy that goes out of your system. It's important so that it at least shares to the public opinion things that you've discovered while working. And this is what matters to us. In addition, in internet, everything is available nowadays. I mean, if you Google things, the lectures are all there. It would be good in an exhibition to share things that are not there on the internet, that you need to, a personal relationship. That's the value of the original. And eventually, sharing the internal cooking of a project. This is what's mainly here. I mean, you double click, understand how a project went up, eventually down, it failed, you made mistakes, or it was a huge improvement. Well, all other practitioners that may have been struggling, decision makers that may not know about this, or the end user that may not know how to ask for quality, may benefit from sharing that internal cooking, and this is another reason for why I do exhibitions. But in our case, it's only every now and then, not very often.
I don't know if there are more questions. Otherwise, I will say thank you to you for the whole thing. And I don't know if you want to know a little bit more about some of the installation, you can ask me or maybe some of you here from the elemental group. So you are free to go around and we are here, I think, in the next half an hour.